you people don't do anything to it. And here there are unions of not taking in the blacks. Another one of our people, teachers in the north side of Minneapolis, which is predominantly black, he says, we sit here and we don't do a thing. I think this is what this lady over here has been wondering, how do we help? Now, I told the pastor, I asked the pastor and I asked the other gentleman too, would you please help me find a black boy or a couple or as many as you can find to help me? I will take them before the apprenticeship board, I will recommend them, and so forth. Now they said, they come up and accuse us in the congregation of not doing it. Now, like you say, we need help. The two come back, the wife of the pastor calls everybody she knew. She called a black pastor in the community, another white pastor who was working with the black, and we didn't come up with a single soul. And sometimes we get this, oh, you're just trying to be a father, Father Tom?
Uncle Tom.
Or Uncle Tom. Yeah, you're just trying to be an Uncle Tom. Now, I think this is what this lady over here has been trying to get at. If we try, but yet are refused, it kind of confuses the rest of us, too.
Can't you understand that we can't trust you now? And can't you understand that we have got reasons for not trusting you?
Then the rocks have to be polished on both sides, don't they?
Well, let's just deal with the real rocks now. You know, I'm perfectly willing to entertain the question of both sides, but not now.
But how do you get the help, or how do we get around this? Now, this is the crux right here. We're right at the point right now. Let's get over the precipice and go one way or the other. How do we help? Let's not evade the question or anything else. Let's get right down the middle of the road and find out how we get off to one side or the other.
How do you help black people?
Yes.
You can't.
Well, then what you're trying to tell the people here that we cannot help you, or help them.
I don't know what the whole point of the whole thing is. You're not helping the black people, you're helping yourself.
Explain
yourself. Well, I don't even have to explain myself. It's been drilled in. That's all I can see all night long. Is that we're not doing it for the black people, we're trying to address our own problem. And I just can't see explaining a 1, 2, 3 what you're going to do.
Well, are you saying then that he helped himself when he tried to get an opening here into this?
No, but I don't think he quit. I mean, I can see his point. I think that was frustration. But still, he can't stop there. And still, he's not.
In other words, he did the right thing, and he can just keep on doing it and trying harder and harder.
But really, he's not doing it all the time. I think it's his problem. He's overcoming his problem. He's doing that.
Okay. Well, this is a good paraphrase. You can put it this way. If you like, that's the way a lot of people would like to put it. You see, you'd like to turn the tables around, wouldn't you? And say, I'm helping myself.
Would you
but
do it? Would
maybe
you?
In this sensitivity training we're having, you are the one that's getting the effect because this is what you would do. Right?
I would do what?
Well, you just brought up the exact statement that I'm doing it for myself, but in essence, you are the man that was thinking this way. Not me.
I wasn't thinking that way.
Well, I know you weren't, but you're trying to say that.
You're interpreting his actions.
Yeah, you're interpreting my actions that I went out to get a black man to become a plumber because I wanted to do it for myself.
No.
Well, that's just what you said?
What
did you say?
Because you have the need.
Well, it's a step to eliminate white racism.
Right.
It's a step to eliminate our problem of being unfair.
You see, the problem is that folks say, we tried to get some Indians to come in and visit with us. We tried to get some black people to come in and visit with us. We tried to give them jobs. Why don't they accept them? Because we can't trust you. That's all.
Well, then there is no hope, is what you're saying.
I am not saying that at all. All I'm saying is that you take the building and trades union, sir. They have got a horrible reputation, not just for racism, but for something that borders on clanism. And if you are not the brother or the sister or the uncle...
Now you're off, my friend. In Minneapolis, you come down, you take a test at Dunwoody Institute, and the top so many people, how many can get into school and go through, are taken.
Black plumbers don't want to work for your firm. You know, we've got all sorts of black.
You know what one?
We've got black building and trade people, you know, in our community now, who own their own companies. That's what we need.
I agree with you, 100%. We're beyond
working for somebody.
There's definitely an asset to our community.
Plumbing for half price, you know, that's... that's tantamount to slavery.
All right, can we get back to the thing? How do we help? Let's get back to this line.
There must be some receptacle, and that's to be understood properly. For black thought, black expertise, and black prowess. And right now, there just ain't none. There just ain't none in the white community. It's got too many problems. Too many problems. Therefore, it cannot be trusted. It cannot be trusted because it does not respond to nor rally around those who say we must do what Stokely said. We must form humanizing movements within our own groups. You know, we must organize. We must do what needs to get done in our community. And we must allow blacks to get their community together. And perhaps the A number one function that we can serve now is to be effective buffers between us and them. In other words, y'all don't let them get us while we're getting ourselves together. Stand between us and them.
This word, or the statement, how can I help? I guess came to me three, 4 years ago. And so when I defined it that the black man needed my help, I found all kinds of things that I could do. And so I did them. And I did what I thought was helping. And then I visited Minnesota Church in Detroit. It was had a white pastor and a black congregation. And I went there to find out, you know, in all good frame of mind, what is the ministry that goes on here? What can I do? I live in suburbia. I know you live in the inner city, but I want to help you. And the white pastor said to us, go home. You can't do anything for us. I got so mad, and right then and there, a bitterness came over me. And it was as if I hated every black person. I just turned, because they didn't want me. They didn't want my help. The whole situation was hopeless. And so how can there be any kind of reconciliation if you, the black man, aren't willing? Now it's what sent me in my state of repentance. I want to do something for you. And then more situations arise and came about in our district, the ALC, and one thing or another. And it was thumbs down from the black people, thumbs down on the white people. And this created more bitterness, and I got more angry. And I got to the point where I was ready for violence myself. And I hated the black man. And I came here on Saturday and I saw Willie. And
I knew that Willow was having these classes on unforced, uncolored, and all this unness with people white. And I hated that. And of course, along with this, what Willie was identified with me. So Willie was in my quote black book. I haven't met a black Christian that has been kind to me, because they've all been telling me what I've done for 310 years. And I'm angry. And this afternoon at 2 o'clock, I was feeling much hatred. And then a compulsion moved me into Sally 1. This afternoon, and I sat and listened to the book being read, and a few things were said, and I shared how I felt. But all of a sudden, there was a graciousness opened up, and it came from Willie, and he was talking about the blacks who were oppressed. But he also said that Jesus is with the oppressed. And I was a cripple. But it was through this black man whom I disliked when I came here, just because he was black and I associated him with all the bitterness that had been pushed at me. It was from him that this grace came, and all of a sudden I see this black Jesus. And that's why I had to ask him this evening, what is he like? What is your black teacher? And now I think I've got a glimpse of who he is, because I felt only a taste of the oppression.
It's now 11:30. I'll go as long as I can. But for those of you who thank you, by the way, for those of you, and I mean that, that's not just, well, words don't really express adequately someone who exposes herself that way. For those of you who want to leave, you know, feel free to go. But for those of you who want to raise some other questions or give vent to some feelings, go right ahead. Yes, sir. I suppose that's one way of looking at it. I think I understand what you're saying. We do want the hindering causes removed, which is something that's got to be done by somebody, you know, assisting us.
Don't do it for me. Don't do it for myself.
Yeah, you see the story of the Good Samaritan, you know, sort of followed up things for us. I like to retell it the way it ought to be told. And the way it is told, very simply, so that we cut the story short, you know. The point of the story, obviously, is to love Jesus. That's the point of the story. The story was told to help somebody. It was told to help the young, educated, fat, white cat, who thought that he had it made, but he didn't know who his neighbor was, so he needed help. And Jesus told him the story. Punter's story, at least as I read it, was that the guys who passed him by, Pharisees and Sadducees, you know, the man who was in the ditch, beaten and bleeding and near death, the people who passed him by did not refuse to help him. They refused to be helped. You see, it was the lawyer that was in the ditch. And the Lord was trying to help him to see that he was in the ditch. Not hopelessly trapped, but trapped. And stewing in his own self-righteousness. And his having placed some rather high premiums on who he was. And his definition of himself, if you check that in the Bible, was not really who he was, but who he was not. I am not a Samaritan. I am not uneducated and illiterate. I am not this. I am not that. I am not this. Look at me, you know. Wow. The Lord said, I've got to help this guy because he is in bad shape. And so I'll tell you this story. And that's why the story was told.
Everybody had a right to say, I don't trust you. That's
right. That's right. That's right.
Her broken said the other night, it takes two to be Jesus. And little did I know that all of these black people who were crushing me down, turning me off, and making me mad were the black Jesus. And I didn't recognize them. But that's how he's coming to us today. Right there, and you don't see him because they put him out.
Yes.
I just
yell out, Doug, because I can't see hands too well. Go ahead.
Yell. I get a little mad when I hear, you know, you have to find yourself out and this sort of thing. But finally, as the conversation goes on, I think what they're trying to say is that when we say, I want to go out and help the Israel, we assume we're better. And this is the whole problem. We can't help somebody unless we think we've really got something to help them. They're poor and we pity them and we have something they don't have. So to reach out and say, I'm going to help you, it gives me the equal thing.
Yeah, I suppose that's sort of like being helped to death, I suppose. So you're right.
So that's the other idea with that view.
That is what I'm saying. Yes, we. What? Oh, you mean what Bob is saying? Oh.
Yeah. Really. I'm sorry. Really. Really. Put it so beautifully. If somebody says, "I want to help you," I say, "Get away from me." You know? Something I started to say earlier and I never finished with was this thing that I'm strapped with, which is Christianity, and which to me has, much as you pointed out, is that it's come back in my face pretty hard this summer, because I've been here all summer, and I've had to go through this thing and reevaluate what it means to even be able to use that word. To me, at this point, it's through this God-man, Christ. An amazing thing, which is freedom, which I have. You know, I've been strapped with freedom. I can't help that. I mean, it is so heavy on my back, you know, and in that freedom I am accepted. Me, however I want to define myself, I am accepted. Nobody else is going to define me. Nobody else is going to tell me what I need. But I'm going to go through and define myself as to what I am. And I'll accept myself as that, you see. But along with this freedom comes the hellish thing, which is responsibility. And that is tough. And so that really puts me in a hell of a position. Because I got freedom. Along with freedom, I've got responsibility. And I have to define it the way that I define it. And however I define it, I am accepted. Which means that nobody else is going to do that to me, that I have to do it. And I have to take a long, hard look at myself. And that really puts me in a tough position. And the thing that I keep coming back to is, when are we going to begin to accept ourselves for that thing which we define ourselves as, which is Christian, which represents those things? And I can't get out from underneath this.
And did we hear of God's grace?
Oh, yeah, really.
Here is Lutheran Vespers. I don't know if any of you ever hear this. Old Pastor Harry R. Gregerson was preaching one night. And he said, all right, if we get back to this type of dialogue we've been going on, he went to St. Peter, and he says, okay, you need 1,000 points to get into heaven. So this guy sits back and he says, oh, I taught Sunday school. Okay, that's one point. He says, I worked with the youth. Okay, that's 2 points. I went to church every Sunday. That's 3 points. The guy just sat back, scratched his head, and he says, I guess it's only by God's grace that I'm going to get there. He says, that's 1,000 points. Right there, 1,000 points. God's grace.
But you see, for me, you know, I've floated on cheap grace for a long time.
On what?
Cheap grace.
Cheap grace.
Cheap grace.
Explain it, please.
Cheap grace, which says that, you know, God's grace, by God's grace, then I will have this thing.
Mm-hmm.
That lets me off to where I don't do the things which, or be the things which I am free to be. And, you know, frankly, I'll give you where I am at, which is, you know, I don't care for myself. I don't care if there's a heaven. And I'll tell you why at this point, because, you know, I have such a hard time relating to this, and what I'm saying, and which I think that Christians have been duped with for so long, is that they're trying to do the right things for the wrong reasons.
Do we have these pastors in the group that like to comment are not caring about there's heaven?
Well, can I finish? There's a quote written by someone anonymous in the 15th century from Spain that I can't remember exactly, but would we love God just as much and do those things which we want to do, even if there weren't a heaven? And what I'm saying is that so much in my past has made me do things and be things because I have been chasing a carrot, rather than doing and being those things which I am.
Do you know what the word covenant means?
Well, no, you can explain it. I don't know, but you know.
Promise. God has made you a promise. If you will believe in Him, you will have His grace.
But then why are you going to worry about it? I mean, just sit back and live. I mean, don't worry about it. What God has given us His promise, and so why worry about it? You can't do anything to save yourself, so why worry about it?
That's the terrible responsibility of it all.
Right. But
for me, that's just me. I'm not asking anybody else to have that. You know, there's nothing that I can do for that, if you put it so beautifully. I mean, I have that. Isn't that what it's all about? That's my understanding of it. Otherwise, somebody's going to have to go through and redefine it for me. I got it. I don't have to do anything for it. That's the grace. But what I say is, my God, from this, I have a responsibility, which is to me, to be what I am.
What happens, Bob, if you don't fulfill that responsibility? What happens if you don't discover that responsibility?
I don't know if you can hear what you're trying to say.
Well, I'm getting from you a sense of anguish because you're responsible. You're responsible. You don't know. Am I wrong? Am I reading you wrong?
No,
you're in anguish because you don't know what your responsibility is.
No, it's not anguish. It's a beauty that's, you know, that just tears at the inside of me because it's, you know, it's kind of beyond belief that this is really what is reality. You know, it's not anguish. It's so beautiful that I can hardly stand it, you see. But from that, that means that I accept myself, too. You know, I am white, etc., 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 however I want to define myself.
Could you explain, then, why you say you don't care if there's a heaven?
You see, all I can, how can I ever relate to this, whatever it is?
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm trying to find out.
Can I relate to that? We have to answer. I will quote a pastor and quote a pastor in the day.
I might add something here before you do this. please hold your point. It's just that I got to say this because it's terribly important. I am a pastor too. We were historically, I think, kind of bogged down the same way. And for those of you who've not heard it, I'll do the black spiritual again. I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes, but when we get to heaven, we're going to put on our shoes and dance all over God's heaven. That's lust for heaven, you know. Just can't wait to get to heaven to put on some shoes. And then the question is, where is hell? Well, gee, we are catching hell right here. Because we see folks with shoes telling us to wait till we get to heaven to get shoes. That's another dimension to it. I too am not obsessed with heaven. I accept the promises of Christ, and those promises place then a terrific burden on me when I commit myself to his gospel, which is best expressed not in heaven talk, but in the talk which Jesus talked when he walked into the temple. you know, about Isaiah 61, Luke, whatever it is. Now, I guess you can, if you still remember, I'm sorry I cut in.
I guess I'm trying to say just the same thing that probably both of these ministers have said, that the fact that you feel responsibility now is a wonderful, to me, result of grace, because you can concentrate all your energy and all your thinking on the responsibility, and you don't have to worry about the heaven or hell part of it.
Precisely. And that's why I said, I don't care, you see, because, you know, this has been given. And so, you know, I just can't worry about that. I'm no longer chasing that carrot. And the thing that I fear the most is that in Christianity, still, we're chasing that damn carrot, which we already have in our hand.
One black preacher said, I will no longer be bothered by either the shape and size of the beds and the rest of the furniture in heaven, nor the temperature of hell.
But that takes a lot of growing to get to that point.
Yeah.
No, I'm looking forward to heaven.
Let us be growing. Did you say
that? I said I'm looking forward to heaven because I have no son there. So it's different for me.
I got a brother there, too. And if it all works out. You guys wear anything? And, but the thing of it is, you know, if you have that, you see, then.
It's not my obsession. I mean, I don't want to think it's my obsession, but I'm looking forward to that. It's my hope.
Well, there's a big difference. I mean, this is going to be a great thing. It's got to go for living your whole life in order to make sure.
But I mean,
the two sides. Well, I think it's the same size, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'm in a very precarious position, sitting between two pastors.
And I'm a black man, child, son of God. Heaven. Everybody's talking about heaven ain't going there. Heaven, you know, that's another one of them. You know, we've sort of like demythologized some of these things, and they start to make more sense as I listen to the group here talk. The style of the life of the master supports what's been said. Kids say he was a failure at 33. You know, that's what they say. Failure at 33. At the end of 33 years, he had nothing to show for having lived 33 years. Even the tomb that he was buried in was a borrowed one. Nothing to show for it. You see. So there's something to be said for living a very, very crooked life. I'm maybe one of these days I'll do the diagram. Something to be said for. And it has to do with things seen, felt, and smelled. Right now. And if we accept, you see, the last judgment scene, that sort of tells us where it's at, doesn't it? You know, I keep repeating that. That sort of tells us where it's at. Being a Christian means that we have involuntary responses to what it is that hurts people, and we move against that. And we move against it with everything that we've got in our being. What being a Christian means. Being a Christian does not mean sitting down and yelling heaven. Does not mean that at all. One of the basic banes of the existence of a lecturer at Holden is that he has to violate all of the sanctity of the pulpit and other things that preachers usually enjoy and take cues from the pews. So when he's asked to talk about things, even if he doesn't know anything about them, he at least tries to talk about them. I suppose that the topic this morning might require a lot more psychoanalytical expertise than I've got, but there are a few practicing psychologists around. Sharon's one, and there may be a few others who may be able to chime in whenever the discussion might move away from some of the practical, much clearer areas into some of that. So I don't deny the practice of that science, and I do not oppress the science, but I've always said that psychologists and psychiatrists and sociologists are very fine people if there's nothing wrong with you. Now that now that I've exposed my prejudices and yeah, maybe risk having the lecture placed on one of those self-destruct tapes. I'll continue. It's kind of early to try to deal with the topic, but it sort of follows, I guess, the last evening's topic, has some things which might be revealing and which may help us to understand a little better and which may help us, and I emphasize again, move towards authentic interaction between men of color and men of non-color and men of wealth and poor people. What I intend to do this morning is to just try to deal with two or three of the myths which have surrounded sex as it relates itself to blacks and whites. First of all, I don't really need to give a chalk talk or rip out any examples for you. Sociologically and anthropologically, and pick any others, I am a black man who at least have worked at trying to understand the full implications of being a black man, but not necessarily limiting the definition to that, but that's part of it. I also carry on my person a name, and it's Hertzfeld. So I would suppose that I am sort of an example of the fact that sex between races does work, and it does not create mutants or some weirdo who is no good for society, produces a man who is quite pleased with himself and does, I suppose, work at turning off that side of him that's German. So I could be the answer to George Wallace's agonizing over the miscegenation question. Then he says, we don't want to mix up the races, because if we mix them up, we'll get all kinds of misfits and freaks in society. Well, if I accepted George Wallace's definition at this point, then I suppose I would have joined the 350 plus people who have gone from the Golden Gate Bridge in our town. So there is a reason for my being sociologically and anthropologically black, and there's also a reason for my having the name Hertzfeld. Now most black folks, because they had forgotten their name, and could not even speak Swahili or Efik or some of the other languages of Africa, when they were freed and they needed last names, usually picked up the last name of the master. So it happens that the master on my father's side of the family was Hertzfeld, great-great-grandfather Hertzfeld. And the master on my mother's side was Heiningberg. So one could say that I belong in the Lutheran Church, and that excommunication is sort of impractical for a man who's so thoroughly German. How did it happen is the question. How did I get the name? Well, my folks, of course, did assume the slave name. But it was more than that. We are children of the slave master. His children. And of course, the name is something that we have. Without taking it upon ourselves, we deserve it. It is ours. Children of the slave master, but yet listed as stillborn, in order that we would not have the right to participate in and to use the antebellum mansions and to be benefited by all of the wealth which we had worked for. Now, Lyle, you can't have children without sex, can you? At least they have not perfected the process, I don't believe. Lyle walked in a few minutes ago, I guess he, yeah. Here he comes again. The fact that black women have almost always been required to enter into sexual acts with white masters is the thing which makes it terribly difficult to find any black person of pure African blood in the United States today. Nearly every black person has some percentage of white blood in his veins. And there are an awful lot of white people, so-called, who have done what we call crossed over into the promised land. In other words, became white, many of whom are aware of the fact that they are black. If we then accept the societal definition that if you have, as a result of sex, 1/10 of 100% black blood in you, you are inferior. Therefore, you are black. Well, enough of that. You might want to talk about that a little bit later on. Myths and black people. Myths about sex. You know, the black man has been sort of, well, now they're going into other parts of the world, and I'm sure that some who have looked at anthropology and understood some of the new terms of cultural anthropology, but understand that the science now is much less oppressive than it was in prior years. But the black man was sort of like the favorite specimen of the anthropologist. And there were all sorts of things that were thought about him and subsequently subjected to study. Reports of army doctors from World War I, for example, reports at least 90% that all black men had much larger penises than white men. This then was transferred into all sorts of myths and gave this as the primary reason for the susceptibility of black men to cave in to the urge to rape. And I remember a speech that I heard, I read the speech first, and it was then since put on a record. And for those of you who have not either seen the play or listened to it, it's called In White America. And it was put on in a little off-Broadway theater in New York. And I noticed that several seminaries and colleges, at least even in our own Lutheran system, have elected to do it in white America. There was this impassioned speech before Congress by a Southern senator. And it goes something like this. When a black animal with the semblance of a man deflowers one of our young white children, then we become so angry and so upset with this animal that our only alternative is to kill, kill, kill. And he goes on and on with kill, sort of like the cadence that men learn now before they set off to Vietnam. Well, it is true that an awful lot of rape has taken place in our towns by black men. No more, of course, than white people, except that black people have always, much less, of course, but you know, we're so terribly outnumbered. But black people have always been statistics because usually they are caught up with. I'm not trying to rationalize or even condone the act. I'll keep going with that so that you understand a little bit of what I'm trying to say. They were always statistics, you know. The quotes, illegitimate children, always showed up on the statistics. So illegitimate children among blacks is a much, much, much higher thing than it is among other races. All of these myths have started to fall recently, and it's been understood now that middle-class families can send their daughters away to Europe and what have you, and they have babies over there, and then, you know, they've just been away on a vacation, you know, and they sneak in, and the child goes up for adoption, and neighbors never knew that the daughter was pregnant. Well, that's just one of the myths. Now, it is true, and several black psychoanalysts have interviewed black rapists. And more often than not, each black rapist is a sort of self-appointed black winged avenger of his people. And what he does is he attacks and tries to hurt desperately the one symbol that he thinks white people are inextricably linked to. And that would, of course, be his woman. We found out that the rapists were making a terrible mistake, that white women were not really that important to white men. They were property and chattel just like black slaves were, for the most part, and terribly, terribly unliberated. Same difference today, if one accepts the fact that we are being plagued by a plethora of students of Hugh Hefner. And the most obscene pictures I've ever seen of white women and of at least two black women are those retouched centerfolds of Playboy. Terribly obscene. The retouching of them, the obscene part. Well, why did Eldridge Cleaver become a rapist? Now, for those of you who have not read it, you ought to pick up, please, Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. And Eldridge Cleaver in the book, even though he was never convicted, confessed to many, many, many rapes of white women. And he starts, of course, though, by confessing that he perfected his technique, his raping technique, by first of all practicing on black girls. And when he thought that he had perfected the technique, then he went across the tracks and really went after what he was going after anyway. There's much less sex involved in this whole process, as Cleaver points out, and a lot more giving vent to frustrations brought on by overt and covert suppression. At some point in the history of this country, then black men lost their manhood, and this created some rather serious problems for them. There are some psychiatrists who wondered why the record of lovemaking among white men and black women always included some call on the divine when climax was reached. For example, the black woman would yell out loud, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus." It is basically because black women having sex with white men thought that it was pretty much like having sex with God. All of the power symbols were represented in white manhood, and all of the things which the heart yearned for was represented in white manhood. And so there were an awful lot of black women during the days of slavery who became what we call house niggers, while the men were, most of them were field niggers, except for the few who kept the stables going and who held open doors for people, who gave themselves willingly to their masters. And even in the South today, there are black women, sharecropper women, who give themselves willingly. And the old plantation mystique still continues in certain sections of the South, where the white man is free to visit the slave shack and to keep his woman on sort of a mantelpiece. Black men see that, and the urge to retaliate, to get revenge for that, often becomes an urge which they succumb to. Well, enough said about that too. Now, one cannot close without talking a little bit about the very old, very ancient profession that women still practice today. It is called, one of the gals that I talked to in the Tenderloin in San Francisco says, don't you dare forget when you say it to also add very honorable profession. Okay. Well. Now, I've done that. We are presently involved in a study, and it has to do with the fact that San Francisco is a seaport town, an awful lot of sailors and what have you. And what we are doing is trying to figure out why. Why is it that when the Enterprise stops in San Francisco, the sailors will pass up 30 Caucasian women in order to get to the lone black woman standing on the corner? We've talked to them, and well, some of the conversation at this point is privatized, but we have started to ask why. Conclusions, of course. Well, you know, you like to reach them before you really write them down. Is that there's something magical about attaining the unattainable. And the problems with black manhood is that they lost almost all respect for their women, because from the time that we grew up, and here I place myself in that category, from the time that we grew up, we were surrounded by sex symbols. And none of them were black. Living color and stereophonic sound. You know, even when we went to see a Cleopatra movie, and Cleopatra was not white, most of us know that, I presume. First of all, it's primarily a study of Claudette Colbert's anatomy, and then later on, Liz Taylor's anatomy. You know, all playing Cleopatra. And so, automatically being surrounded and informed by all of the visual stuff that we were bombarded with, including Playboy magazine, we could not accept the fact that our women were beautiful. And many men lost their sexual urge for their women, which means that they really lost what I would call authentic sexual desire for all women. Well, let's stop there. Maybe we'll have some questions that'll reveal some of the other thoughts I have. If you've noticed, I have dealt very, very, very little with specific Christian thought this morning. Not that I'm not aware of the fact that it is involved, but the topic itself sort of ought to lead us into that. If you want to read some very interesting cases, which present in a very vivid fashion what I've just described, pick up Black Rage. It's by two black psychiatrists whom I argue with all the time, and I make statements like I made before, and I'm attacked by them. But you know, psychiatrists are by and large non-violent people, as are psychologists. They then elect to whip you with the pen. These men are now coming out with a new book, which is the second stage of the study, and it's called The Jesus Bag. And well, that happens to be my bag, so they have interviewed me now. So I have been one of the prime targets of their study. And at least three of the sessions were classic put-ons, which may get into the book, I don't know. But then finally, we started to get angry with each other, and I guess some truth was revealed. But these men are very, very competent men. William Greer and Price Cox, they're both psychiatrists, and they both teach at the University of California, Berkeley. It's a very fine piece, kind of light for those of us who desire something more, but a terribly good primer for those who are trying to get into why black rage for the first time. Well, let's the whole problem of at least some of the cases involving sex and racism is in the book, so I commend it to you. Questions, comments? Whatever.
You can continue going at all and tell why the psychology of castrating the black man who is lynched. What percentage is it? I forget.
Okay, yeah. Yes. I'm glad you asked. Well, I, you know, you think about things, and I had something written down here about that. And I said, well, maybe, you know, we'll just skip it. I've got about 10 paragraphs on that. But let me see if I can speak to your question. Even as late as the Algiers Motel, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Algiers Motel. It's a motel in Detroit. There seems to be some worry about a child falling here. Yeah. Joanne? You got him, huh? Okay. He could hurt our state trooper here. Oh, I hope you didn't mind my letting people know that you were okay. That you were a law enforcement officer. Even as late as the Algiers Motel incident. The Algiers Motel incident, I commend that to you for reading also. It's tough reading because of all of the emotional input of the writer. There's a copy of it in the library here. Remarkable place. You know, you can find a lot of things now. But there's a copy of it in the library. For those of you who might want to browse through it earlier. Where the young black men were put against the wall in the motel and shot to death. But before they were shot to death, the barrels of the shotguns were placed against their vitals and all of their vital organs were blown away. Their sex organs were blown away. There's some rather interesting comments on why that was done. And it sort of reverts back to then that period when black people were feared sexually because allegedly their sexual prowess is much greater than white men. Well, there's only one in the room who really knows if that's true or not, and I ain't talking. So almost total paranoia about the sexuality of the black male possessed his lynchers. And almost invariably, whenever black men were hung, they were castrated, de-sexed. There's one who was castrated who's still alive, by the way. The only black man who was castrated by whites and lived. It's sort of interesting the way it happened. It happened 50 miles from where I had a parish. He was taken out by Ku Klux Klansmen and castrated alive. And they poured turpentine into the wound. And that saved his life because the turpentine cauterized the wound, stopped the bleeding, and he was able to walk into Birmingham. We are committing to print through the Black World Institute in Atlanta, Vincent Hardy, this man's story, including all of the conversation which went on while the act of castration was being done. And I suppose Cobbs and Greer could really have a field day with that, because the conversation is quite revealing of the paranoia about the sexuality of black men, which then is sort of evidenced by the castration of men. Almost, well, the statistics show something like above 80% of the black men being lynched, you know, being castrated. There were laws, incidentally, in places like South Carolina, which were really something. You know that there was a black truck driver in South Carolina that was arrested, tried, and sent to jail for reckless eyeballing? Reckless eyeballing was the charge, looking at a white woman in a lewd and salacious way. There were a lot of arrests that way. Emmett Till, for example, which is a very, very famous case. young boy, got uppity and apparently talked to a white woman in Mississippi, and they discovered his body some weeks later, stuck between some roots of cypress trees in the Pearl River, Mississippi. So they're all, these are more recent cases. One of the most famous, of course, is the Scottsboro, Alabama case, which has been written into history, where while the young men did not admit to rape, it's still not known whether they did rape a young white girl or not. They were still executed for it. You'll find some of the transcript from the trial in Jim Cohn's Black Power and Black Theology. That's a long answer to your question. But there's an awful lot of, in fact, you know, we have looked at individual cases, and you know, the reasons almost invariably get back to that one reason. But it's interesting if one's stomach can take it to explore some of these cases and to pick up dialogue from them. Frightening too. Lana?
What about the resurgence of the black man's image in itself?
Yes. All kinds of beautiful things happen as a result of that, you know. One, he appreciates and loves black women, which means that he has respect and love for all women, you know. Two, the urge and to become the black-winged avenger diminishes with the discovery of manhood. You know, you discover that you're not an animal, but that you are a man, and that being a man carries with it the awesome responsibility of recognizing the humanity and the dignity of other people. Cosman Greer really makes an interesting point about this, you know, and they say that Stokely Carmichael really released a beautiful black spirit from that road in Mississippi. And from that time, from that point on, more black men than even under the leadership of Martin King stood up and became men. Walked like men, talked like men, and became really sexual creatures. You mean the black family? I suppose that, the nuclear family concept, Lyle, as you know, is under fire. Now, not only from it's being, you know, seriously threatened, not only in the white community, but also in the black community. We find in our own family that there is a strange mixture of our African heritage and also of our American heritage. And I know, you know, sometimes this creates concern on the part of white people who see Tress and myself. You know, Tress and I have minimal conflict, not as much as we're supposed to, according to you. But then, I don't know if I'll buy that for us. I'd say, well, maybe I ought to listen to Lyle, but then maybe I shouldn't, you know. But the conflict is minimal. We have weird practices in our household, you know. Some of the rituals, you know, I think you did a thing on rituals here one morning. You know, some of the rituals are distinctly Afroid, you know, which then does something at least to the stylized concept that we have of nuclear family or of the family constellation. I think that the children relate much better to that. It gives them a sense of motion and rhythm and, you know, and a certain kind of thing that most folks would not have. Even with our devotions when we're at home, you know, this ritual happens. Elmer Witt was the first one that I had heard of who did the same thing, you know. I mean, maybe for devotion sometimes we would read Alice in Wonderland, you know, or Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and then draw theological applications to that. In fact, that's where some of my lectures and illustrations came from, you know, from around the family table. The uniqueness of Eastern people to draw word pictures, you know, in the ritual is a thing of beauty. So and we've picked up some of that. We also include some of the very, very ancient Eastern things which come from men like Khalil Gibran, who is not read because he's not a Christian, you know. But I also commend him to you and several other of the Eastern philosophers and poets, which does something, you know, at least to our style of family life. Suspicion and fear, you know, of unfaithfulness is minimized. It could well be that we may not accept the one man, one wife idea, but that we will uncover the horribleness of men who claim so, but who really don't believe so, you know. Enough of that. That might serve to confuse people more than it might to help people. Basically because it's a difficult thing to proceed now, you know. But if it helps any the regaining of identity and manhood and womanhood too, in that respect, does something for the family, and I suppose that it will probably create something other than if you want examples of children who are generally messed up, like children, and you know what I'm talking about. You know, they run the whole gamut of the mental diseases, brought on, of course, as Moynihan would suggest, by the breakdown, not on purpose. You see, black folks sort of got used to that because babies were ripped out of mother's arms during the slavery period, you know, and just sold. Men were separated from their women and placed on the auction block and sold, you know. So the whole idea of family just disintegrated, you know, in the black community starting with slavery, and we're just starting to recoup some of that. That's another long answer, but you know that there's so many... Okay, yes, sir.
What is then the state of gratitude with the original Americans a week or so?
I'd love to do that, but I shy away from doing that because the Native American ought to be here to speak for himself, and until he is, I may elect not to. Right. Besides that, I have to go visit them a few days after I leave this place, and they you know, I'm going to spend 2 weeks on the Rosebud Indian Reservation, and I'm going to have a dialogue with a gentleman who just finished a rather interesting work called Custer Died for Your Sin.
My thought is this,
and so I have to be real careful about speaking for red people. My wife, of course, is part Cherokee. But according to the Alcatraz Indians, when we had blue cards to get onto the island, they accept the fact that she has elected to live on her black side as opposed to her Cherokee side, which has nothing to do with her disrespect for, you know, or she does not dismiss the fact that she is part Indian. She's proud of it, but her own familial situation sort of demanded that she be black. That this is the way she was raised. She could have been either one.
My feeling is that should you spend some time there, or that there should be spokesmen or writers for them as there are now for blacks.
Yes, they are.
To learn, you know, much about, and this one we're going to have to learn too, so they could tell us some horror stories too of our white in the history of our life.
Yes. But you know,
what is going to do gradually with the white?
The one, you know, one section of the dialogue that we are planning with our red brother is that For God's sake, don't just limit yourself to horror stories. You know, but that's where the red people are right now. They've got to tell all of the horror stories, not to refresh anybody's memory here, but to have people aware of what's going on right now. You know, it's not really history, it's what's going on presently. But I'd really like the idea of, and maybe, you know, maybe soon we will be able to have some of our red brothers sit around the campfire here and enter into a powwow with all of us. I personally have the experience quite often. I'm familiar with most of the offices of the American Indian Movement and several other situations. And like I said, 2 weeks on the Rosebud Reservation this summer may serve to broaden my own experience and understanding of red people. I understand a bit of the culture, and I know most of the history that's available now, but I sort of elect not to talk about it, if you don't mind.
Sure. Your Indian affairs you need to be concerned about, too. You decided about it a month or two ago with that
eye-opener,
the horrors of now.
Yes. I agree. The Bureau of Indian Affairs are putting the Alcatraz Indians through all kinds of changes. The Alcatraz Indians reclaim Alcatraz under a treaty of 1888. They said, the treaty says that any unused government land should revert to its original owner. Well, they claimed it under that treaty. And they said, it's ours, we want the deed to it, we'll even give you a handful of beads for it. So, you know, which is what the white man gave the red man for Manhattan Island, you know. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs comes in and they say, we'll make it a park and we'll put some Indian statues in there. You know, they know all kinds of weird things. But we both agree that if black people had taken over the island, even under the 1888 treaty, they would have been bombed off of it. So the Indians at least have the advantage of conscience at this point. We hope that they can hold on. They need water, and they need money. For those of you who've got some extra water or extra money, send it to me, and I'll take it over to them. I saw a couple of hands, but I can't see hands back here, so you'll have to yell out. I should go here. All right. Yes. Yeah, the reason that most black women were employed was that there's always been a crying need for domestics. And most black women were deployed as domestics. Not only domestics, but also mothers for white children. You'd be surprised at how many of your white leaders were raised by black mammies, so-called. I mean, leaders today. Even wet nursed by them. You know, I mean, even milk from a black woman's breast reared a lot of white men and women. So they were employable. Black men had no marketable skills. Consequently, they found it rather difficult to get jobs. People don't realize it, but if all of the black domestics in this country were to withdraw, the state of affairs would be a lot worse than a market dive on Wall Street. There are an awful lot of white families who do not know how to care for children, but they've never had to. Too busy making money and going off to the islands and vacationing and stuff like this, and black women raise their children. There's another little book called The Desegregated Heart by Sarah Patton Boyle, a very old piece, and she also wrote another little book with Charles Edwin called For Human Beings Only. It's got two sections, a black section and a white section, and she speaks both to her black brothers and to her white brothers. Sarah says that she grew up with a black mammy down in Virginia, and finally, when she was 12 years old, she became Miss Sarah. When she was 12 years old, and she was lectured, and it was pointed out to her that the black mammy who had raised her was less than she was, and that she now must demand the respect of the black servants in the household. You see, if you really want to see people get mad, you let a Shirley Temple movie come on, the Late Late Show, in some of our big cities now. It's permissible to show them at Holden and in some other places, but they're not allowed on television by black people now. But the whole Shirley Temple syndrome is sort of a picture of how blacks related to white children. Can you imagine a 70-year-old man looking down at a little girl going, yes'm, yes'm? Anything you say, Miss Shirley, yes'm, you know.
Well, returning to the question of the beauty of practices of black women, that an idea I want to bounce off of, using that idea to bounce off of as well. But anyway, it's called Miss America.
Yes.
For one thing, we've got a terrible hypocrisy. We call that Miss America when we need to be sort of word of it, Miss White America.
There is a Miss Black America contest. It started in California. It started in my town. Originally, it was Miss Bronze America. Finally, after our Chicano brethren said, you folks are not bronze, you're black, we are bronze. if there's a beauty contest, it'll be, Miss Bronze America for Chicano people, and not for black people. But, at that point in history, we were just uptight about using the word black. So we did have a Miss Bronze America contest, and most of our beauty winners were the fairer type, more like me, Texture of hair was very similar to mine. Color of skin, very similar to my own. As close to white as you could get without being white. Well, I don't know. Maybe some of the ladies here ought to give their opinions. I wonder whether that's Miss White America or not. The women are revolting, fellas. This year there's a black entry from Iowa, and sort of interesting. She's a student at Luther College in Decorah. The first black woman ever to get into the Miss America contest came from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. The Lutherans are on the march. She said that she was not elected because of her blackness, but because of her talent. She was interviewed in San Francisco Chronicle, and this is what she said. She succeeds a beauty who is preparing to become a Lutheran teacher. Miss Nebraska and Miss Iowa were both Lutheran, but were both girls preparing for Lutheran school teachers last year. Yeah, well, see, this... But, there will be black people who would say, give us our, black women who will say, give us our chance to compete in the Miss America contest. And this is what this young lady is doing now. But then I, well, I'll just withhold my comments on it. I suppose that, well, she's going to be attacked by women white women. Any, I think any of the women will probably have some serious questions about that now. You know, the last contest, there was a big demonstration, I believe. Women burned their bras and girdles in protest at the last contest. Is it a contest or is it a promotion for Helena Rubinstein is really my question. Tony and Pepsi-Cola, okay. And Oldsmobile, okay.
I don't think it's ridiculous, and this is another subject. My history prof in college firmly believed that America as a democracy still had a hangover and an anchoring for monarchy. He believes that the Miss America pageant is this. And going on this series was not also related, it shall not soon be overcome.
Very interesting. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And this is where maybe, the clients and the comments are trying to help us see the broader picture of what that is that we need rather than
Yeah, you know, doctors in our town, for example, are getting rich with silicone injections and silicone operations. Because most women, you know, who are not 36 or 38 or 44, you know, feel oppressed. And they are made to feel inferior to other women because of all of this misguided adulation about what's beautiful, what's sexual, you know, and what's not. And so the sexual creature is not defined in terms of who she is. But in terms of who she is not, you see. And this is the basic vein of the existence of self-definition at the expense of someone else. See, I really think that the church might do well to establish a ministry to the losers at these contests. I think that there might be some good, there might be some quick conversion. You know, it's sort of like some of our guys minister to the losers at Las Vegas and Reno. You know, I mean, we stand by the slot machines and we watch the little old ladies when they put all their money in, and when we see the razor blade, we know what they're going to do. You know, because the whole competitive syndrome about who you are when you're a loser. Or who you are when you haven't got what she's got, you know, is terribly destructive. And I'm sort of happy that college students have got some other things on their minds now. There's a Miss Everything, Miss ROTC, Miss Footballer, Miss Baseballer, Miss Basketballer, Miss June, Miss May, Miss... You know.
Where I was brought up, most of us were first generation black and mostly Polish, Hungarian, and so on. In all of the families, there were many generations living together. And now I've noticed in the white family, they have they're no longer living in many generations. In our black families, most of them still are. Is this economical or is it desirable?
It's for economical reasons, of course, but it's working out well,
yeah.
You know. And we are, you know, at this point, the absence of money becomes a blessing. The presence of money might mean, you know, a sudden rise in homes for the aged for blacks, for example, you know. But we don't have that now. But you know this. Oh, you know, I mean, you can't go into a community in California where you don't see at least two or three of them, right? Homes for the aged, you know, convalescents. Yeah, that's it. Convalescent homes, you know, hospitals and, you know, things
homes
like this.
Homes
for senior citizens, yes. We've got a fanciful one across the Golden Gate Bridge with a very, very exotic name called Rolfe Memorial Manor. You know, it's the church. The church has it, see? And it's really a cage designed to put those who are no longer useful to us into. And we don't grant them, you know, the privilege which God grants them in old age, the privilege of entering into life in the company of their family. I've been called out several times to places like the Livingston Hotel in Oakland, you know, and old men, you know, move into these places because their children don't want them. And this very, very tragic case was an old, elderly, Lutheran gentleman from out in Iowa or someplace. You know, I'm not going to give the position of the son because somebody might know him, you know. This old man died in the party in this hotel. And the son was contacted, and the son just sent a telegram and said, contact the Lutheran pastor and bury him. And I'll be glad to take care of whatever expenses are incurred. I remember telling the funeral director, I sure wish I could send this guy a bill for about, you know, $500,000 and make it stick.
Well, my question was, will the black community move into this kind of life as they economically can? So
I don't believe.
Have the same problem,
I don't believe so. We have sensed the dangers of that. It's difficult to tell, you know, what might happen. You know, say if power and money corrupts, as some folks think it does. And I have no argument with that. But I suspect that the ritual of the black family will hold it together. Now, even with your bourgeois, upper middle class black people, you'll find elderly black people in the home with them now, even those that have money. I know this is true in the case of both our godmothers, you know, in Washington, D.C., the children brought them into the home with them. It is true in the case of my family, you know. My father and mother now have got my grandmother and an aunt in the home with them. Now, you know, naturally my father calls me and he says, I really am having trouble. Both of the old ladies have diabetes, you know, and they'll sneak and eat cake and, you know, and stuff. Over the Christmas holiday period, they were both in the hospital at the same time, you know, for insulin shots, you know, ate cake and then didn't do the insulin right. They still use the old method of injections because the pill seems not to have effect on them, you know, after they've been taking it for so many years. So my father, goes through the very pangs and torments of the damned, you know, but then he celebrates the fact that he's able to care for them. And to the way he puts it, after all, they reared us. And if they had not created the climate, then the Hertzfelds could not be the people that they are today, because we had nobody but each other. You know, so we, we resisted putting them in convalescent homes and things like this. By the way, my grandmother is 87 years old, and she still flies around the, you know, flies around the country occasionally, and drinks bourbon, and, you know, does some rather interesting things. So that at least makes it a little easier on my dad, is that they're able to sit down and have a drink together. It's past the time. Does the circle belong to someone else now?
Nope.
At 11 o'clock?
11.
Well, those of you who want to...
No coffee on Saturday.
But those who want a breakdown, it's free to go. Yes.